About half of Americans say the leak of classified information about NSA surveillance serves the public interest. Slightly more say whistleblower Edward Snowden should face prosecution. What do you think? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Polls on the NSA revelations reveal a split in American opinion. We'll talk about what that means this hour. Also claims that such surveillance foiled terrorist plots. We'll also get analysis of the G8 summit and talk about the implications of a Supreme Court decision on voting rights. Politics Day, today with Dennis Goldford and Bruce Nesmith, starts right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Some people call Wednesday Hump Day. We actually like to call it Politics Day here on River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Dennis Goldford is with us, professor of politics at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Great to have you back after a little bit of an absence from our program, Dennis.
Spring's always tough for college professors.
Okay, glad you got through it in good shape. Bruce Nesmith joining us as well. By phone, the Joan and Abbott Lipsky Professor of Politics at Coe College. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Dennis.
Bruce.
Now, we want to continue a theme we had last week on Politics Day and reach out to our listeners, because quite a bit of opinion on the NSA surveillance and difference of opinion, as we'll talk about in some new polls about those revelations coming up in just a few minutes. We want to ask now our listeners, are you swayed by the administration's arguments as we learn more about the scope and process of sifting through data for possible security threats, terrorist threats? Join our conversation in a few minutes when we talk about that. 1-866-780-9100 or rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk with your thoughts, with your questions on that topic. Let's get to the latest news, though. President Obama this morning, today in Berlin, speaking at the Brandenburg Gate in Berlin to a far smaller crowd than he saw 5 years ago when he was a candidate for president. Some 200,000 then, now I think estimated just 6,000 today in Berlin. He spoke today about U.S. foreign policy, and he spoke philosophically about people across the globe seeking freedom, and he had a specific policy he wants to aim to reduce nuclear weapons.
Peace with justice means pursuing the security of a world without nuclear weapons, no matter how distant that dream may be. And so as president, I've strengthened our efforts to stop the spread of nuclear weapons and reduce the number and role of America's nuclear weapons. Because of the New START treaty, we're on track to cut American and Russian deployed nuclear warheads to their lowest levels since the 1950s. But we have more work to do. So today I'm announcing additional steps forward. After a comprehensive review, I've determined that we can ensure the security of America and our allies and maintain a strong and credible strategic deterrent while reducing our deployed strategic nuclear weapons by up to one-third. And I intend to seek negotiated cuts with Russia to move beyond Cold War nuclear postures.
President Obama today in Berlin at the Brandenburg Gate proposing to reduce American nuclear arsenal by as much as a third. Dennis Goldford, what is the significance here? We talk so little about nuclear politics, strategic nuclear arsenals these days. What is the significance here?
Well, you know, that's a hard one to figure out. There's nothing saying that a president can deal with only one particular matter at a time. There's several things on a president's plate at any given time. But you're right. This is not something that's been in the headlines lately. This is not something that seems to people, in terms of foreign policy issues, perhaps the most immediate and pressing of issues. There are other things. This is partly why some people have difficulty with what Washington's doing. I mean, not to change the subject, but the Republicans, of course, passed a bill in the House with severe restrictions on abortion that won't go anywhere. While most people are concerned about the deficit and unemployment and the health of the economy, they're working that particular hobby horse, and President Obama's working this particular hobby horse.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not likely to go anywhere if it requires any kind of senatorial approval. Republicans aren't going to go for this at all.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, your thoughts?
I think Dennis did a pretty good job of summarizing my thoughts. I'll throw in this additional note, is that if you're going to tell me that Obama was going to make a big speech on foreign policy today, I would have expected it to be about Syria, or that would have been my first choice, or maybe about terrorism or international trade, the stuff with the European agreement and things like that. Those, I think, are what's on my mind, and I think those are probably the issues that seem most urgent to the American public in terms of foreign policy. So where this comes from, I don't know. The only possible hypotheses are either A, this is something that can be done, and therefore, you know, we can check it off the list, or B, having nuclear weapons is costing us money in an age when the budget is being vice-gripped. Maybe this is a place where we could save some money on defense.
Well, let's talk about Syria, one of the things you mentioned there, Bruce, during the G8 summit. Now, that's earlier this week. Northern Ireland is setting. One issue global leaders discussed was that conflict in Syria. The U.S. and Russia have agreed. Actually, they have a disagreement on that situation. President Barack Obama met with Russian President Vladimir Putin, and after their meeting, Putin spoke through an interpreter.
Of course, our opinions do not coincide, but all of us have the intention to stop the violence in Syria, to stop the growth of victims, and to solve the situation peacefully, including by bringing the parties to the negotiations table in Geneva. We agreed to push the parties to the negotiations table.
Okay, our opinions do not coincide. I love diplomatic speak. Of course, that was a translator to Russia, long supporting the Syrian regime, while the Obama administration insisting that Bashar al-Assad has to go. Bruce, what did you hear? What did you see in this statement put out after the G8 summit about the progress, if any, on talks to end this two-year civil war, claiming nearly 100,000 lives?
Nothing, really, other than I think that there was an agreement on an aid package, and I think even the G8 statement was that the aid package was a lot smaller, less than a third of what they wanted to provide. I think we haven't figured out what will move President Putin in terms of being able to obstruct this, and that the West now needs to decide, should they just go around him if they want to do more than they're doing? Should they just go around him, or is Russia just going to be too much of an obstacle to effective action in Syria?
Mm-hmm. Dennis, with the Syrian regime making advances in recent weeks, is there really any hope of negotiations?
Well, I think you tend to negotiate when you decide you have more to gain from negotiations than from what might be in play on, in this case, the battlefield. So to the extent that the battlefield prospects begin to improve for either side, that side's going to be less likely, I think, to be interested in negotiations, given the very radically different perspectives and orientations of each side. It just, the whole thing reminds me of Henry Kissinger's supposed statement during the Iran-Iraq war, which was, it's a shame both sides can't lose. The difficulty in Syria, of course, is that Assad is particularly an unsavory ruler. He comes from a very unsavory history of rulers, his father, for example. But we don't quite know for sure who's on the other side, and that seems to be a mixture of groups, including al-Qaeda types. And the question is, do we want to arm people who, in fact, may use those weapons at some point against American interests?
Mm-hmm. I think what you've got is an area where we don't really know, we can't really define what the American interest is. What's the desired outcome? And I suspect that if we had a clearer sense of where our interests lay and what outcome we wanted, then we would not, it would be less easy for Russia to obstruct Western action.
What about either of your thoughts on other happenings at the G8? We had ambitious trade negotiations mentioned. Also, I think G8 leaders with some sweeping goals, tightening tax rules on these big corporations, international corporations that are using these loopholes to shift profits into some foreign shelters. What else caught your attention from the G8, if anything, Dennis?
I think it's really the continuing difficulty to get out of the economic circumstances we're in. The U.S. is improving. They're still struggling in Europe. Germany's doing all right, but with everybody bound to the euro, pretty much determined by German interests, you know, they gave up the mark, the solidly stable mark, in order to join the euro. And it's made it difficult for countries with weaker economies like Greece and Spain and Portugal, to some extent Italy, to conduct their own fiscal policy. And so they're in the difficulties they are. I think something like 25% of young people in Spain are unemployed. No, young people, maybe 46%, in fact, that I've read recently.
Right, the overall one is 25.
Right. I mean, that's just horrific. And as we know from the 1930s, that's where nasty things happen, when you have all these particularly young people unemployed and they become more responsive to groups that are further on the fringes.
Okay, let's move on from President Obama in Berlin and the aftermath of the G8 in Northern Ireland, back to our theme that we've had for several weeks about the National Security Agency's revelations. NSA Director Keith Alexander testified on PRISM and other NSA surveillance programs before the House Standing Committee on Intelligence. This was yesterday morning. Here's some of what Keith Alexander, the director of the NSA, had to say.
We have been able to connect the dots and prevent more terrorist attacks. The events of September 11, 2001 occurred in part because of a failure on the part of our government to connect those dots. In recent years, these programs, together with other intelligence, have protected the U.S. and our allies from terrorist threats across the globe, to include helping prevent the potential terrorist events over 50 times since 9/11.
And in that same testimony, here's Representative Mike Rogers. He's a Republican from Michigan's 8th District, questioning NSA Director Keith Alexander about the NSA's surveillance capabilities on yesterday's hearing.
Is the NSA have the ability to listen to Americans' phone calls or read their emails under these two programs?
No, we do not have that authority.
Does the technology exist at the NSA to flip a switch by some analyst to listen to Americans' phone calls or read their emails?
No.
So the technology does not exist for any individual or group of individuals at the NSA to flip a switch to listen to Americans' phone calls or read their emails?
That is correct.
Okay, testimony yesterday, NSA Director Keith Alexander. More than 50 terror threats throughout the world having been disrupted, more than 10 of the plots targeting U.S. homeland. I wonder, should we trust the NSA when they say these things? And get some more details on the process. River-to-river listeners, what are you thinking? Are you swayed by these arguments as we learn more about the scope and the process of sifting through data for possible terrorist threats? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. You can post a message, a question on our Facebook if you like, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Dennis Goldford, the Obama administration making a good case here?
Well, you know, as usual, they're struggling. This is an administration that has a great deal of difficulty selling its particular programs, whether it's drones or healthcare or this sort of surveillance. They need to be able to sell this more and alleviate people's fears. Now, to some extent, of course, we tend to underestimate and forget how much really we do leave markers of our activities everywhere. You don't have to be paranoid to realize that, well, yeah, if I try to use my GPS in my car, that's going to a satellite. Something could be recording where I'm going. Mm-hmm. Or if I use my ATM card or a bank card, let alone a credit card, there's a record of that transaction. That's why criminals often like to use cash, because cash is anonymous. And we're in a society where increasingly we're leaving a footprint or a record in ways that we normally don't even think about. What's interesting is that, of course, there's a fine line between, with regard to what the government does, there's a fine line between what I'd call healthy skepticism and kind of conspiracy-oriented paranoia. And in the 1960s, that line was breached. You tended to find that kind of conspiracy-minded paranoia on the left among student radicals and others. Now we tend to find that kind of conspiracy-minded paranoia on the right, particularly with the Obama administration and their tremendous mistrust of it. And the NSA surveillance, of course, feeds right into that.
Okay, your thoughts on the NSA surveillance. We're looking to you, River to River listeners, 1-866-780-9100. Matt joins us from Des Moines. Your thoughts on this, Matt.
Hi. One of my main concerns with it is the fact, and it hasn't been brought up a whole lot, is the security surrounding these systems, because obviously, like, it's been shown that Verizon is providing the NSA with these call records and stuff. So the system, it's obviously a networked system where they can access those records. But what are the protections surrounding that, and what prevents somebody from gaining unauthorized access to that? If we do trust these analysts with it, that's fine, but what prevents somebody from the outside being able to access that information and using it for something it's not intended to be used for?
Matt, taking it to another level, I'm not sure we have the expertise to answer that question.
That Bruce, never stopped me before.
Okay, Bruce, then have a jab at it.
I would. It's interesting to me that the reason that Edward Snowden, the fellow who leaked this, the existence of these programs, knew about these programs is because of the connectivity that the NSA director was talking about in the testimony, the clip that we played. In other words, maybe 15 years ago, or back in the 60s, in the J. Edgar Hoover era, the information would be tightly held, and it was able to be tightly held because we didn't have the expectations that agencies would be sharing information. So I think that the callers, while I'm not able to speak to the technical aspects of his question, I think the question is a good one simply because so much of the ability to deal with terrorism requires that information be shared across agencies of the government.
Mm-hmm. Matt, thank you for that call, that question from Des Moines. Let's move to Sarah in the Quad Cities. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I think my comment's along those same lines, but I don't have a problem with them spying on anything that I'm doing as long as they are looking for terrorism, which is supposed to be the whole point of this exercise. I happen to know of someone that was several years back arrested for poaching, and they were able to arrest this individual due to provisions provided for in the Patriot Act. Mm. And I don't think that was not the original intent, and I think most Americans would be fine if they're not going to abuse that information.
Sarah, thank you for that view from the Quad Cities. As a matter of fact, let's go back into a little bit more of how this is playing in the public, because according to new polls, the public is divided over to whether this leak of classified information about NSA phone and internet surveillance serves the public interest. A majority says that the former government contractor, Edward Snowden, should be criminally prosecuted. And a new national survey conducted, I guess this was June 12th through the 16th, by the Pew Research Center and USA Today, 1,500 adults, finds that 44% think the release of classified information about the NSA program harms the public interest. 49% say it serves the public interest, so slightly more in serving the public interest. And Dennis and Bruce, this is interesting. I'd like you to comment on this when we look a little bit deeper into this polling. 54% of the public, including identical majorities of Republicans and Democrats, say the government should pursue a criminal case against the person responsible for leaking. And in this other aspect, young people, by 60% to 34%, think that the NSA leak serves the public interest. Americans 30 and older are divided more. 46 say serves, 47 say it harms. So it's interesting that we have across party lines. This doesn't seem to be a partisan issue.
And I think that's been part of the way the administration has gone about responding to it, that the president has made some statements, but he's pretty much taken a back seat to to people like the Alexander, the NSA chair, and there have been some other law enforcement people speaking out on it and allowing people like John Boehner to be very public about what they say. So I think that's partly the administration strategy. I was struck that this poll that the Pew Center for the People and the Press has released has just got a lot of fascinating numbers in it, and they're very much to be commended for the detail that they released. There are quite clearly some people who feel both that the release of this classified information serves the public interest and that Mr. Snowden should be prosecuted, which is I'm not sure if I can explain that combination, but there are definitely, if you add the numbers together, they add up to more than 100. So
let's go to some callers before we have to take a break. Let's try Marshall in Cedar Rapids. Marshall, what's your view on this?
Afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
I consider myself probably a social liberal, but fiscally I'm kind of right-winged on things. But my thought is that if the government's nosing around in my cell phone and my email and all of my activity links to me potentially causing terrorism in the country, then absolutely.
Okay, Marshall, you're breaking up. I think I see where you're going. You're saying perhaps spying's okay if it's going to stop some terrorism. Okay, John, Marshall, we're going to move on to John before the break. Sorry, your line was breaking up. John in Ankeny, we're coming up on a break. Share your view, please.
Well, I as I told our call taker, I don't trust anything in this particular administration and others in the past. It seems like the media or the public have to beat things out of them. The classic case is the two rogue agents in Cincinnati. I'm surprised they didn't use that with the NSA. There was a couple rogue agents in Boise, Idaho or something. But they just don't want to come forward and be honest with us. So again, I end my comment with I just don't trust
okay.
anything.
Thank you, John, for that view from Ankeny. Here we see some of that interesting poll data in the opinions of people listening to this program. Dennis, we've got less than a minute before we go to a break. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, the difficulty is if you're in a position of responsibility in government, you want to be the person in charge the morning after there's another 9/11 attack. So you're caught. You want to be able to prevent that sort of attack. That's the great good that would be done by this. But the great evil would be if the government, in fact, uses this information for unscrupulous reasons. The other side of that is if we prevent the government from using this for unscrupulous reasons, you run the danger of preventing the government from using this information for what we consider good reasons to prevent an attack. That's what the dilemma we're caught in.
Okay, when we come back, more Politics Wednesday here on River to River. Dennis Goldford with us, professor of politics at Drake University. Bruce Nesmith of Coe College with us, dissecting our political landscape as of late. When we come back, we're going to talk about continued slumping approval ratings for the president. Also, where is immigration now? What about those two sticking points, the path to citizenship and border security? Will they find a compromise? Also, an interesting ruling from the Supreme Court on voting rights. We'll talk about that. Women in combat, also still to come. We'd like you to join our conversation on any of those topics, 1-866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Back with Bruce Nesmith and Dennis Goldford. Politics Wednesday on River to River in just a moment. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. If you've noticed, popular TV dramas and many of this summer's blockbusters are set in post-apocalyptic worlds. Summer things going on. This is the end. One of them, World War Z, After Earth, Elysium. Tomorrow on this program, we'll take a look at why the end of the world is such a common theme this year. I'll even talk with some Iowans who are prepared to face an apocalyptic scenario, and also with someone from Iowa Homeland Security to find out how prepared the state of Iowa is for disaster. That's tomorrow on the program. Today on the program, No disaster, nothing that big, at least not that we know of. Bruce Nesmith with us of Coe College, Dennis Goldford of Drake University, talking about politics in Washington. Actually, some do call that a disaster, don't they, gentlemen? Let's talk about President Obama's approval, even as Americans mostly back the National Security Agency's controversial practices. We were talking about those in our first half hour. The data mining of phone and internet records. President Obama's own approval rating has suffered slightly. A CNN ORC poll released earlier this week found that Obama's approval rating, the number of Americans who say he's doing a good job as a president, is now underwater. That is, more Americans disapprove of the way Obama is handling his job than disapprove. 45% of Americans said in this poll by CNN that Obama is handling his job well. 54% said they disapprove of the job he is doing as president. I wonder if you can elucidate that. Bruce Nesmith, what's behind the slump in approval ratings? Are we still having the repercussions of this trio of controversies, the IRS, Benghazi, Justice Department, and journalists?
I think it's, as far as I can tell, it probably has most to do with maybe the journalists, but maybe more the NSA stuff. If you think about, you know, where the variability is in terms of his approval rating, conservatives never liked him to begin with. So, you know, the fact that a lot of them are quite outraged about the IRS and Benghazi doesn't reduce his approval rating, since they couldn't hardly go any lower. But and I think maybe people on the left tended to be more favorable, maybe more amenable to the administration's explanations on those issues. But as we see, and again, I'm going to go back to this people in the press stuff. The people who are most outraged about the NSA are the right end of the conservatives. And right behind them are the left end of the liberals. And I think that's probably where a lot of people have turned from support to opposition, or at least rather approval to disapproval, to keep it in the language of the survey.
Mm-hmm. Dennis Gold, for your thoughts and whether this even matters, how much it matters, the president's approval rating at this point in his second term.
Well, you know, people talk about approval rating as being part of a president's political capital, but I think that you know, presidents typically get a honeymoon, although this president's honeymoon was over pretty quickly, after the initial election, and then it tends to dissipate. And getting reelected is, in a way, a confirmation to some extent that at least a majority of people, or a majority of electoral votes, approve of what you've done over the course of the first 4 years. But it's not in and of itself necessarily a particular mandate. And I think that we saw that with the difficulties the Reagan administration got into as early as December after the November election in 1984 with the Iran-Contra scandal. And they lost the Senate. Republicans lost the Senate in 1986. And for the president to think that if he were reelected, this would, he said, break the fever in Congress, that in some way predisposed Republicans to be more willing to cooperate with him, that was simply unrealistic politically, and that indeed has not occurred at all yet. But I think Bruce is right. I think that you've got a number of people on the very liberal side of things who don't like what the president's doing because they see it as a continuation of what George W. Bush was doing. And in terms of surveillance and all these various kinds of policies. And on the very right side of the, of our politics, you've got people who will, on the one hand, take any kind of club rhetorically to use to beat the president over the head with. But also they didn't seem to have, with some exceptions like Bob Barr of Georgia, they didn't have a lot of criticism of these same kinds of techniques that occurred during the George W. Bush administration.
I wonder, since we had this flurry, this trio of controversies just a few weeks ago erupt, and it seemed like we were asking the question, is this a turning point in the Obama administration, the administration's handling of the targeting of conservatives by the IRS, the talking points after those attacks in Benghazi on September 11th, 2012 in Libya, and the revelations that the Justice Department had targeted journalists' phone records as part of a leak investigation. What has become of that trio of controversies? Have they faded? Do they matter much anymore?
Well, look at the terminology you've just used, if I can fend off Bruce for a moment. You've adopted the kind of terminology, I think, that you've had coming from the conservative side of the spectrum. Maybe in some sense the journalists were targeted, but when you talk about conservative groups targeted by the IRS, well, that's not really what happened. You had these groups applying for tax exemptions, which immediately brings them attention of the IRS. Now, the IRS was incredibly incompetent, and their sense of public relations was terrible. But did they, on their own freelancing, go off to target conservative groups? I don't think that's been established. But the way you've just referred to those continues. And shows the success of the conservative narrative that we've had for quite some time.
And we should mention that this morning on NPR, I don't know if either of you caught it, an investigation into this as we discover more and more about it. The IRS also targeting, if we're going to use that word, liberal groups as well as conservatives. So there you have it. Let's talk a little bit about immigration because there has been some movement on that front in Washington. House Speaker John Boehner said yesterday he does not see any way of bringing an immigration bill to the floor that does not have backing from a majority of the House's GOP members. Some of the Speaker Boehner's comments from yesterday, let's have a listen.
I also suggested to our members today that any immigration reform bill that is going to go into law ought to have a majority of both parties support. If we're really serious about making that happen. I don't see any way of bringing an immigration bill to the floor that doesn't have a majority support of Republicans. We know that that border security is absolutely essential if we're going to give people confidence that we can do the rest of what's being suggested. And I frankly think the Senate bill is weak on border security. I think the internal enforcement mechanisms are weak, and the triggers are almost laughable.
House Speaker John Boehner yesterday. Bruce, can I turn to you for the status of immigration reform and those two sticking points that House Speaker addressed, path to citizenship, border security especially. Will they find a compromise?
That's an excellent question. I think that the chances of finding a compromise are probably greater on immigration than they are on any other issue that immediately comes to mind, other than maybe something to do with surveillance, because at least part of both sides are motivated to reach a deal, and that makes a lot of difference if you compare to say the health care bill, where Democrats wanted to do something and Republicans didn't, and it's hard to compromise on that. I think what we have here is the both parties, but particularly the Republican Party, is divided on the issue about whether the bill, any bill, should move forward or not. Border security is a kind of a it's a good thing, but it's hard to measure. It's not a binary thing. You're either secure or you're not secure, and so I can't see any bill going forward that would be that you couldn't attack on the subject of border security. So if you didn't want that bill to go, you could find some reason to criticize its provisions on border security. There are Republicans who feel that that immigration is an issue that is damaging them with Latinos, and that they have a chance to do much better among Latinos, as indeed they have in the past, if they lighten up on immigration. There are other Republicans who feel that looser immigration laws, whatever verb adjective you want to use, are just very, very bad, and won't help the party, and will damage the country, and all sorts of other things. Mm-hmm. So that's the real question: is can those opposite viewpoints on the Republican side find some kind of acceptable middle ground language? Absent that, I would not see the bill going forward for the reasons that Speaker Boehner articulated.
Dennis Goldford.
I think Bruce pretty well covered it. It's hard to see how it goes very far. I mean, the difficulty is that as a policy matter, from the standpoint of particularly Tea Party elements of the Republican Party, illegal is illegal. What don't we understand about that? In other words, they take a strong stand on that principle. That's fine, but as a practical matter, people are not going to come along, and I can't remember what the figures are for illegals in the country. Is it 11 million, something like that?
Yeah, 11, 12, something like
that. Okay, nobody's going to come along and physically and forcibly evict 11 or 12 million people out of the country. So as a practical matter, you can say, yeah, it's illegal, but what are we going to do about it? And that's the difficulty that both sides are in at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that in a boost for proponents of this comprehensive immigration reform, there was a new report from the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, estimates that the immigration bill currently being debated in the Senate would increase the U.S. population by 10.4 million and would decrease federal budget deficits by nearly $200 billion in the time frame between 2014 and 2023. I don't know if this changes the debate, but it certainly may get some people on board. I'm not sure.
That was the Jeb Bush argument, I think, at the Faith and Freedom Conference. And he got roundly, if not booed physically, he got roundly disparaged.
He was using CBO numbers?
I can't remember if it was CBO numbers, but he was arguing, look, we don't have enough people in terms – he made that sort of clumsy statement about fertility.
Right.
But he was saying basically, look, Americans in the citizen sense of the term are not reproducing at a high enough rate to support our economy. Think in terms of, I think it was, a long time ago, 16 workers for every person on Social Security. Now it's 2 workers for every person on Social Security. So he's saying we don't have enough young people coming up to support the economy. At least that was his argument. And he was arguing that also these people would become taxpayers and help pay for some of the spending or pay down some of the deficits. But he didn't get a big groundswell of support in Republican ranks for that.
Let's talk a little bit about the Supreme Court ruling this week and one to come. States may not require additional proof of citizenship on federal forms designed to streamline voter registration procedures. That was a ruling the Supreme Court announced on Monday. It rejected a requirement passed by Arizona voters in 2004 that potential voters supply proof of eligibility beyond an applicant's oath on the federal form that he or she is a citizen. And this was a 7-2 ruling. Any surprises here, Bruce?
Maybe the size of the majority, and maybe Justice Scalia, who kind of leans towards states' rights on a lot of things, wrote the decision. What they based it on was provisions in the 1993 voter law, and I can't remember the official name of it, but it had a number of provisions, including motor voter, to try to expand access to registration and voting. Passed at the time when Clinton was president and Democrats had both control of both houses of Congress. So I think that law contains statements that this is all you can ask for.
Any wider implications of this ruling going forward? Do you want to jump in on this, Dennis?
Well, it involves some difficult constitutional kinds of themes having to do with the relation between federal powers and state powers. I'm not surprised to see Justice Thomas in dissent because as to whatever extent Justice Scalia, as Bruce suggested, is a so-called states' rights supporter, Justice Thomas is huge in that area. And it goes back to the whole issue of term limits, whether the states can add extra criteria for holding office to what exists already at the federal level in the Constitution. So there are a lot of technical issues there.
Okay. Today, on another Supreme Court decision yet to come, yet to be announced, Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska said she supports legalizing same-sex marriage. This is the third GOP member of the Senate to endorse the right of gay and lesbian couples to marry. And it comes, we think, days before the Supreme Court is set to issue those decisions regarding the Defense of Marriage Act, and also California's ban on same-sex marriage. Murkowski joining Republican Senators Rob Portman, Mark Kirk in support here. I'm wondering your thoughts on what politicians, especially in the GOP, where there is controversy here. What do they have to gain by coming out, so to speak, with their opinion on same-sex marriage before the decision, Bruce?
Well, I think with Portman, it was a personal thing, right? It's somebody he knew or somebody in his family. And
right.
With Mark Kirk, he is a Republican senator from a pretty blue state, Illinois. For Murkowski, it's harder. And of course, you know, I don't want to be, you know, sound like everything has political calculations. There could be personal conviction involved, too. For Murkowski, I don't know. Alaska, it's very libertarian, but I don't know that that has necessarily shown up on gay rights kind of issues. So I'm not sure. I'd have to find out more.
Dennis Gold, for your thoughts.
Well, you know, I think people are rushing too quickly to say, oh, yes, this is the coming thing. The country is moving well ahead of the Republican Party in terms of the issue of gay rights. That may or may not happen. Some particular politicians on the Republican side, like Murkowski and Portman and Kirk, may have announced a support for the idea of same-sex marriage. But right now, they're the exception that proves the rule. Still, the Republican Party is anchored in a strongly, strongly socially and religiously conservative base. The party cannot win without these folks. And if you two were to go ahead and en masse approve of the idea of same-sex marriage, you're going to alienate these folks. The problem for the Republicans is they can't win with those folks alone. They've got
But they are discussing, are they not, within the party, the degree to which social issues should be pushed in the next election.
Yes, and look at what the House did yesterday with the restrictive bill on abortion. So and almost the entire Republican House membership that was voting, with I think it was six exceptions, voted for that particular bill. So, yeah, there may have been that report suggesting downplaying social issues, but the Faith and Freedom Conference that was just held over the last weekend, Ralph Reed's operation, they keep threatening the party, saying you do not want to ignore us. You do not want to ignore our concerns. So the Republicans who are tactically concerned with winning elections are increasingly caught between a rock and a hard place.
Let's touch on one more point in politics this week before we have to say goodbye to you, Dennis and Bruce. By 2016, women could be permitted to train for most combat roles, including infantry, artillery positions, under some detailed plans released by the Pentagon yesterday, describing how to integrate female troops through the armed forces. But military leaders made clear that they will move cautiously as they lift remaining barriers to women in combat and indicated that after further review, some jobs will probably remain open only to men. Here's Lieutenant General Howard Bromberg, U.S. Army Deputy Chief of Staff, describing the components of the integration plan.
Our plan, as you'll see, has basically four lines of effort or four major avenues of approach here. And that's first by opening positions that are previously restricted by the direct ground combat assignment rules, such as I just talked about, those positions in the brigade combat teams. And then their second line is to focus on gender-neutral standards, focus on the task requirements as we move forward. And then our third line of effort is focused on a gender integration study, looking at those social and cultural aspects of integrating women into formations where there have never been women historically before. And then our fourth line of effort to work very closely with the Special Operations Command as they move forward in those areas where we're expanding opportunity for women there.
Okay, not much time left, less than a minute to have your thoughts on this. What's driving it? To what degree are politics mixed in with this, Dennis Goldford?
Well, of course, women are increasingly occupying all sorts of positions in the workforce and careers that they never used to occupy. And we have a substantial number of women in the military. And there are people who argue that there's certain things that women simply should not do. There have been some politicians who say Americans don't want to see women come home in body bags. The difficulty is that in places like Iraq or in some cases Iran, it's not like World War II. There are no real differences between the front lines and the rear. Everybody, in essence, is on a front line. So to what extent do you want to allow for that kind of training necessary to survive there?
Okay, we'll leave it there for this week. Thank you very much for joining us. Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Bruce Nesmith joining us by phone, the Joan and Abbott Lipsky professor of politics at Coe College. It's been an enjoyable hour with you, gentlemen. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Julie Englander today in Des Moines. Help from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. And Charity Nebbe has stepped into the studio. Hi, Charity.
Hello, Ben.
I bet you're going to tell me what's on tomorrow.
I am, and it's a bittersweet show tomorrow because one of my very favorite guests, and I think one of your very favorite guests of all time, is coming in, pianist and composer Dan Knight.
Oh, great.
But he's coming in to say goodbye because he's moving away from Iowa, but we're going to talk about saying farewell, what his plans are, and we're also going to celebrate summer with Songs of Summer as well. He'll have a keyboard in here.
Okay,
we'll
so we can have listeners be suggesting summer tunes.
Right. If you have to pay for your tune with a story, though.
Oh, that's
you
right.
Don't get to just pick a title. You have to give us a story. What does a summer song mean to you? And then Dan will play it.
I bet you've got a few in mind already.
I'm working on it.
Okay. We'll see if our listeners can reach out tomorrow during the 10 o'clock hour of Talk of Iowa with Charity Nebbe. Get a song. Where else can you do that? You get a song, and all you need to do is pay for it with a story from your life. Connect it with a song. Tune in tomorrow. Talk of Iowa with Charity Nebbe. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.